Hello again. Thank you. If I could have your attention, please. Thank you, everybody. We have so much to discuss. Appreciate your attention. Again, I'm Dan Gibbons from the City Club, and we have a perfect group of Chicagoans here, civic leaders. Welcome back. What an incredible Chicago weekend we had, right? The most beautiful city in the world. Another great week to come, and so much good happening. So thank you for spending your time being here on a Monday. If I could please have your attention, we want to acknowledge a few folks that are in the room, because here at City Club, when these people come together, it's when good stuff happens. Commissioner Bridget Gaynor is here from Cook County. Commissioner Sierra Boatwright from the City Planning Department. And Commissioner Lizette Castaneda from Housing. Both previous speakers and future speakers here at City Club, as of course was Commissioner Gaynor and Jessica Caffrey, who's here also. She's with the Land Bank. You've heard from them here on this stage. And just a great mix, as you all know from business, and Jamil Boussab is here, Lori Glenn is here, guides us in some programs. Jackie Gomez, welcome back, and your team. David Greising from the BGA is here. Jackie Holston, we recognized earlier. Aisha Jacko from Westside United. Mary Kenny, who's a recovering public servant. And a great friend of City Club. Thank you, Mary Kenny. Blue Pacheco Cornejo, we know, building the Blue Azul Center. I went and visited on the sell side. Diane Primo, thank you for always being here and being supportive. Sam Royko is here. Stacy Young is here, who's done so much. Again, another recovering public servant who's probably the incredible expert on housing. Aaron Aylman is here. Just a great group of mix of developers, of policymakers, as I mentioned, Kurt Bailey, related so much they've got going on, advocates, civic leaders in general. At City Club, we take our role very seriously in convening all of you and using it to really call attention to challenges, but really amplify solutions and work on the solutions and bringing the public and private sectors together to affect change in our great city. So. And we're committed to tackling the right issues. As you'll hear on the way out, we have a whole host of programs coming up. But housing is one that is going to take a lot more than this conversation today. As I mentioned, we had Commissioner Castaneda and Commissioner Boatwright. They both touched on housing. There's going to be more to come, and the stage is only so big, as I say. But we're going to have, hopefully this is one of two, possibly three conversations where we will dive deeper because there's just no lack of topic here and subtopics with housing. So committed to doing that here at City Club and hopefully with the input of many of you experts for these future programs. So thank you for that. I'm going to hand this over to a man who's spent many years at that intersection of public and private sectors, and this is how we've been programming at City Club. We're bringing experts in who know City Club and who know the issues and who know the right people to get on the stage, and we do this in partnership. So please share those ideas with us along the way, as David Doig did with us today. So he's a former public servant, again, former park superintendent, planning commissioner. He's currently the president of CNI, Chicago Neighborhood Initiatives. I think many of you in the room know David. So please welcome back to City Club, David Doig. And I'd like to also mention, as David comes on up, Matt Fiasconi was unfortunately not feeling well last minute and asked yesterday if he could cancel, and hopefully we'll get him. So David will introduce our other panelists, and we'll have Matt on a future conversation. Thank you, David, for your partnership in this.
Thanks, Dan. So as Dan said, this is really the start of what will hopefully be a ongoing and recurring discussion around housing. So I'm going to try to frame some of this today, and then we'll have a discussion with Leon and Sarah to talk more specific. So I wanted to start with a brief PowerPoint. Well, thank you all for coming. It is a sold-out crowd today, I think, which does speak to, I think, the interest in this topic. I think this is obviously a national issue. If you think about questions around affordability this whole discussion about even achieving the American dream, is that attainable for people anymore? And so in many ways, Chicago is an example and I think a case study in some of the more critical issues around affordability that we're facing nationally. So I wanted to start with this slide. So this looks at housing production really over the last basically, it's over the last 65 years, and you can see in America, we've basically been creating, that green line is 1.5 million units of housing. And so you can see it went up in the 70s, and then it dipped when we had the inflation crisis in the late 70s, went back up in the 80s, kind of bounced around in the 90s, peaked in 2005, 2006, and then you see the precipitous drop after the financial crisis in 2008 and has been slowly kind of making its way back to the 2020 mark. But now you see starting at about 2020 that it has started to dip again. And so this is holding constant for population growth and other things. But that trend downward is I think, part of the reason why we're facing these questions around affordability and around housing supply. So this slide, it's a little hard to see, so I'll try to. This is 2023. Okay, so 2023. This looks at the top 10 metros. So this is not just Chicago. This is the entire Chicago Naperville SMSA, you can see the top 10 SMSAs were, you've got Austin and Raleigh and Dallas and Houston. And if you see those numbers, Houston, for instance, produced in 2023 77,000 units of new housing, 77,000. If you look over on the lower right-hand side, you see the lowest 10 SMSAs in Chicago was fifth lowest. So we were slightly above Providence, Buffalo, Cleveland, and Detroit. And we produced 17,000 units of housing. This is housing. This is not affordable housing. This is just housing. So this is 2024. Similarly, again, you had places like Dallas, 68,000 units. You had Houston again with over 70,000 units. Phoenix, 45,000 units. Chicago went up a little bit. We were sixth lowest that year at 14,000. 14,000 units for the entire SMSA. So now let me get into like the specifics of Chicago. And again, I'm just kind of framing this because we're going to start to unpack why that is. And I want to attribute this to Steve Vance. Steven's here today. Steven runs a wonderful website called Cityscape and does a fabulous job tracking building activity through permits in the city of Chicago. So Steven cataloged the last 3 years, 22, 23, and 24 permits. 50% of all residential permits were in four wards. Four wards. And you can probably guess which four those were. There were, those are the four wards. 24%, almost 25% were in the 27th ward. We have 50 wards in the city of Chicago. 25% were in one ward. So this shows you where those permits were concentrated. Six wards permitted less than 10 homes in that three-year period. So that means, like, some wards have, like, no permits, no housing permits. And so this speaks to this question of, I think, equity and how do we create a more equitable residential housing market. So what did that look like? So in Chicago in 2022, we permitted 7,100 units. That dropped in 2023 to 4,400 units. Dropped again in 2024 to 4,000 units. And you can see how those. What's interesting here is the single family detached housing units, 405 in 2022, 288 in 23, and 321 in 24. We're not building single family homes in Chicago anymore. Even though about half of our housing stock is 1 to 4 unit buildings, we're just not building. So with that, let me call up our panelists, Leon Walker. Leon is the president of DL3 Realty. And Sarah Jane Wick from Related. All right, so now that we're all depressed, what are we going to do about this lack of building, and particularly the lack of housing? First of all, let me get your take on why it is that Chicago is falling behind other smaller or even peer cities in terms of what we're building. And I'll start with you, Sarah.
Okay. Can everybody hear me? I like to pretend like I don't like the mic, and then you get on it and you like get a burst of energy. So I think there are a couple of things going on. So number one, the thing that strikes me the most with the cities that are highest, they're in Texas. Texas is highly unregulated in terms of their ability to build. So it's a lot easier to build in Texas, and you're now seeing it in the numbers. I think it's a lot harder to build here than many places. We've also seen, I think, obviously everybody knows the stats. You know, we've seen construction costs rise along with interest rates. That's happened nationally, but you're still seeing activity in certain parts of the country. Again, I think those are marketplaces where those areas make it a lot easier to build. They're just not as regulated.
Yep. Leon, your thoughts?
Well, for DL3, we really started in housing out of need and necessity. We started out 25 years ago focused on the demand side of the equation, which was producing more jobs and opportunities for our citizens so that they could even afford to live in Chicago. We saw then about 2018 that we couldn't bring more retail, more sort of community assets in the, whether it's grocery stores or coffee shops or other kinds of jobs and amenities if there weren't bodies. So you need more stomachs to feed, more backs to clothe, more feet to put shoes on. And so we started in the housing because we saw that acute situation where we had all these neighborhoods that were clamoring for more retail, more job opportunities, more amenities for their neighborhoods, but they didn't have really the demographics to support those new uses. So what do you have to do? You got to bring the population back. We have a real structural issue here in Chicago, and now that we've gone headlong into it, we understand more of the dynamics about this issue. You know, historically, Chicago was, we all are very proud of our neighborhoods. You know, I think we have 77 still. Do we have 78 now? Maybe. Yeah, okay. So we have 77 neighborhoods, right? Or 78, on the verge of here. And so, but we're all very proud of those neighborhoods. But most of these neighborhoods historically were populated by 2 and 3 flat buildings, which provided a naturally occurring affordable housing supply. What has happened over the intervening decades is that we have, you know, really eliminated, you know, those opportunities, either through conversions, demolitions, et cetera. So that naturally occurring supply, that foundation of the affordable housing stock, is no longer really present. And we've leaned mostly on the building of, you know, built towers, multifamily units, and such. And that is, you know, where we get into the buzzsaw of problems, because production of that kind of, you know, high density construction and living, you know, is subject to policy issues ranging from building permits and zoning laws and NIMBYism and all kinds of things. Not to mention, which Sarah just talked about, is the public markets and the macroeconomic environment. So what I like to talk about is really in terms of, you know, as if we get to some solutions here today, we can all sort of commiserate for a while and talk about the problem that we know we're experiencing, which is not just unique to Chicago, by the way, but is, you know, this is a supply side as well as a demand side challenge. You know, so most of us in this room, because we're in the actual production of housing or spend our times and our careers in that area, we focus on the supply side. How can we get more units built? Dave showed the numbers, you know, permit starts and constructions and completions. But, you know, there's also a demand side issue, you know, cost burdens and other things that I hope we'll get into a little bit.
Great. Thanks, Leon. So, Sarah, you talked a little bit about some of the barriers, and I want to push you a little bit on, I mean, I understand Texas, but, I mean, other cities like Charlotte and Denver are outpacing us significantly in housing starts. So what are, in your opinion, are those specific barriers that are constraining our ability to deliver at scale?
Well, I think there's two things to unpack there. So one is, post-pandemic, we saw capital markets really pulling out of larger cities. So I would say Chicago got pulled into that. I think those other markets are improving. So we're optimistic that we'll see, you know, private equity coming back into our marketplace. But I do think that we certainly have a reputation as a city of not being an easy place to do business.
What do you, I mean, be specific about that. What is that? I mean, that's a nice generality, but what does that mean practically as a developer?
It takes a long time to get a building permit. It takes a long time to work through your zoning and entitlements. You know, I think some of it feels like you could withstand, but every year that goes by, it seems like we're getting more and more divisive. You know, folks that were once your peers, you're now showing up, and it's getting harder and harder to sort of work within an environment toward, I think, a shared goal. I think, you know, we saw this administration last year publish a list of items that they sort of acknowledge that it is hard to do business here, and they want to change that. But I sometimes worry that that doesn't get into the, like, detail. You know, it's almost like each department needs sort of an overhaul. And this all falls along the lines of, it's probably no mystery, but I really like the Ezra Klein abundance way of thinking, which is that, and it's because it sort of speaks to me. I am very results oriented. I want to see the numbers. What are we building? I'm less interested in, you know, how much have we allocated? What have we approved? I want to see that the units are getting built. Again, that's in part because I am a hyper-literal thinker, and the weight of the supply-demand disconnect keeps me up at night. So I think, you know, where I was going with this is that one of the things Ezra Klein talks about in his book is that for every regulation or policy initiative that you add to a process, we need to think about removing. So, you know, one in, one out, because if you sort of look at if you look at every aspect of a development job, and I'm going to be the like micro piece. Leanne's going to take us back out and talk bigger picture. But if you look at, you know, if you take every aspect of your development project, every single item has now 10 more pages of documents, maybe not even 10 more pages, 100 more pages of documents. You know, if I go back through our binders from 20 years ago and I look at the construction contract and it was 8 pages long, my construction contracts right now are 600 pages, and we have a lot of attachments that all say the same things. Now, again, that's a micro piece of what I think is a larger problem. But I think that will help us if you can focus in on some of those very minute details. I think you start to make it a little easier for folks to do business here.
Thanks, Sarah. Leanne, what give us some of your analysis on process and cost and why Chicago is lagging in terms of our peer cities in terms of new construction.
Okay, so first, let's, you know, this is not a Gordian knot. I mean, I think we can actually, you know, get to some good solutions. I want to just address one issue that's been out there, and Dave and I have this, you know, conversation frequently about the, you know, let's just use some rough numbers: 800,000 to build an affordable unit versus 400,000 to build a market rate unit. And so I say, you know, when you look at it on a per unit basis, you can tell that story and support that argument. But the challenge is when you really look at it in terms of what are you building. So, because LIHTC is, you know, capped financially.
What's LIHTC, Leon?
Low-income housing tax credits. Because the subsidies that, you know, build affordable housing is capped financially at a certain number of units that can be financed without the gap getting outrageous, you're looking at 50-unit projects. Now, when you look at, you know, a market rate development, if you look at what usually gets financed, it's about 300 plus or minus units. So, you know, there are economies of scale.
And the easiest, is there a prohibition against using LIHTC for 300 units?
Yes, I'll tell you why, but it's not it's more policy than rule. What I will say is that you have the same size roof. So when you're building a 50 unit building, you've got, you know, 4 floors, 5 floors, but you've got this size roof. When you're building 300 units, you're going up 20 to 24 floors, and you're going up taller, same size roof. So that's just to give you a visual of economies of scale. To put a finer point on it, you know, the fees in the stack are not 6x. There may be more, might be 2x, but it's not 6x. So what that means is you're gaining efficiencies as you get bigger. And so that's one issue on the cost side. And so we get caught up in these, what I think are distractions from us solving the problem. Now, in terms of what can we do to really produce more units, the supply side, and then we're going to come back to the demand side. I think we're going to stay on the supply side for a moment. You know, Chicago has a unique opportunity among most major metros in that we have land. Land is either a liability or an asset, depending on your viewpoint and your understanding and faith in the future. If we view that land as an asset that can be, you know, put to productive use, then it becomes an asset for us. But what do you build on the land? I think we have to have all the tools in a toolbox. So I'm not saying that we should do anything to limit LIHTC. I agree with the expansion and the tax credits, the lowering on the basis calculations for 4% deals, et cetera. All of that will help. It's just not a solution. We keep looking for a single solution, a silver bullet. This is a complex problem that's not going to be solved by just one policy. So, yes, we continue to produce housing through the tax credit program, but we've got to look at other ways that the, you know, government and we as the people can actually encourage the market to make some better decisions. So how do you do that? I think we need to focus on that 2 to 4 unit supply and those infill developments.
Before we get to the solutions, Leon, so just two other, I guess, kind of issues. One, and I touched on this in this slide presentation, is the inequitable distribution of residential units.
Of what now?
The inequitable distribution of residential units in our city. The fact that 50% of all permits were in four wards. Sarah, can you kind of speak to that? Why are we only building in certain areas of the city, and why is that?
I am always surprised, I think as everybody else is, that there has not been more activity in the neighborhoods where we've seen where we now have a lot of vacant land. It's a surprise to me. I think. I moved here from Brooklyn 15 years ago, and when people talk about gentrification, things happened really fast. I would have friends come visit, and I would drive them to Midway, and you're driving through portions of the West Side, and they were like, wait, are we still in Chicago? Because I'm so unaccustomed to seeing so much vacant land. And I share those sentiments because we are the third largest city in the country, and I feel like we can do this. We can figure this out. But in large part, I think we're seeing, you have folks who maybe aren't willing to move into some of those neighborhoods, therefore not increasing demand. I think in general, we've seen populations continuing to move north. We need to start shifting that and pushing folks to want to start moving into the neighborhoods. I think it's an amazing opportunity because I'm in the generation of folks whose parents had single family homes, and then it's not as accessible to us nowadays. And so I'd love to see stronger growth in that place.
And so, you mentioned New York. Certainly, like, development in New York is much more kind of widespread. It's throughout the entire city. And other peer cities like Houston and L.A. have similar kind of development patterns that are much more broad-based, are not singly focused. Leon, why do you think that we have such intensity in certain areas and basically no action in other areas?
So, Chicago is a unique cauldron.
A what?
Cauldron. A place where we can mix things together and create some really...
Are you talking about a stew here?
Yeah, man.
A witchy stew.
So what happens is we have, if you look over the history of Chicago, we have produced, leaders in every area, not politics, business. We've seen the largest, black and minority companies, banks, media companies, and others come out of Chicago, not to mention some great political leaders. So I think there's something unique about Chicago that creates these nationwide models. And we do have an opportunity here. But what we are struggling against is, some historical facts. And, Chicago not only has led on the positive side, but on the negative side. And on the negative side, we were, we generated and cultivated the restrictions on where people could live. That has a legacy. We have, with the federal government actually created redlining. There's a legacy in Chicago that we have to deal with. There's a balkanization. We know we are prideful about our neighborhoods, but that sort of neighborhood pride also creates the them versus the us and the we argument. So when I say most of our issues revolve around them and they, where we see our fellow citizens not as common people united in this project of Chicago, but we see each other as competing for scarce resources. We see each other as the other, as more dangerous, more not someone we want to live next to. So that is a perception that I think can be changed. Okay?
How?
Well, okay. Now
we're going to solutions now. So
I think part of the story is the economic one, which Sarah is talking about when she says it's a great opportunity. I think that people are motivated by the opportunity to build wealth for their families, but you also have to deal with the fear, and the fear can be real. And, a lot of times we're not, I even, speak to my friends in government and said it's wonderful that we can talk about, a 65-year low in crime. That's a great statistic, right? But we also have to deal with people are on Michigan Avenue backing trucks into Louis Vuitton. So there is a fear and there is a perception that the media reinforces. So how do we, you know, unpack that and create some and lift up some positive examples in the neighborhoods that are actually ones that, you know, when you're there, you don't you're not having bullets flying. You know, because we've spent our time in those neighborhoods building and developing, and we've been there with our officials, and, you know, there's great projects, great opportunities, great quality of life. So it's micro. It's their shoots right now. But if we can expand those shoots and create, you know, what I call green zones, you know, these green zones can then be expanded upon and create a catalytic impact, not only for attracting investment, but creating some safety bubbles that can attract more people in a different kind of demographic. I talk to people all the time about this. They say, listen, if you want things to stay the same, then we're not the right firm for you to be partnered with in terms of this engagement. We are going to change things. Your neighborhood is not going to look like it's looked for the last 50 years. Now, it doesn't always mean racial change, which is what the buzz thing is, right? It can, but it's certainly going to mean that we're going to have, you know, collared, you know, folks that are managers and above working in these communities. And there is evidence that shows that when you change the composition of the neighborhood, and it's not 50% plus. I want to take a survey here. Most people would say, oh, the neighborhood's got to have 50% plus managers in order for people to really, you know, start behaving differently and seeing promise and hope and opportunity. No, 10%. And you see a 50% decline in terms of teenage pregnancy, truancy, and all the ill behaviors that we are all concerned about in our neighborhood. So we can actually do this, and I think there's opportunity for that to happen.
So can I build on something that Leon said? So I think one of the things that struck me about what Leon was just saying is that I also think when we look at the neighborhoods, we really need to be talking about scale. So many of our programs and incentives are sized based on what, like, how much money the city has to subsidize. And then they're also looking to subsidize across a lot of different neighborhoods. And that means that their resources are... they don't have enough to go around. But I think to do sort of the one-offs within the neighborhood is not going to get us there. So we do have to start looking at how we get to bigger-sized projects and what that might mean. And just dialing, going back to what some of the things I was referencing earlier, that might mean that we have to pull back some of our other... you know, some of our other policy initiatives and goals so that we can start to see something move forward in this other direction.
Yeah, we've got to make up lost ground, clearly. So a surge, if you will. And so as you think about this, you know, I wrote something in Cranes in the real estate forum. I said, at the time we had a $10 million solution for a $1 billion problem.
Right.
And so, you know, here's the good news. You know, one is that we're moving. The administration now has a $75 million. They've increased it. That's sevenfold. It's still not enough, but we can start to get some lessons learned and hopefully reinforce and grow the policies that work best. But, you know, when I talk about a billion-dollar problem, and the first time I was talking about this in a closed group, you know, some people, you know, who I thought would have been advocates and supporters pushed back from the table. Oh, Leon, you're talking about $1 billion. Where are we going to get this money? And I was so pissed off, and I couldn't think about how to rejoin that argument at the time. But I came back a month later, and I said, now I get it. I said, oh, when we're talking about $1 billion to invest in our future, to invest in our citizens, and to help change our neighborhoods and make them neighborhoods of first choice instead of communities of last resort, we don't want to spend the money. It's always an argument about when we're spending money in our neighborhoods that it's too much, takes too long, et cetera. But when we want to support the Arlington Heights Bears, you know, we got several $1 billion. When we want to see, you know, us grown men in tights playing with balls, we can find billions of dollars.
So, So we started to talk a little bit about solutions, and I want to kind of highlight one that I think has a lot of promise, and want to just publicly shout out Commissioner Boatwright and Commissioner Castaneda for the Missing Middle Program. I mean, this has a lot of promise. The idea is that you take all these city-owned vacant lots, or some percentage of them, and start to actually build like three flats. Three flats and six flats are the most efficient housing topology in the city, and it's exciting to see these units go in where your per unit cost isn't 800 or even 400, it's 300,000 per unit, and you're providing opportunities for wealth building, income creation, and most importantly, adding density to these neighborhoods. And so those are, I think that's a particularly encouraging opportunity. City has 10,000 vacant lots. The county has how many, Bridget, vacant lots? 20,000?
Well, there's
34,000 tax-delinquent vacant lots. That's on top of the 10,000 that the city owns. Yeah. So we have no shortage of opportunity. What we have a shortage of sometimes is resources and vision. So, Sarah, talk a little bit about some of the things you see as possible solutions to addressing these deep kind of housing disparity issues.
You know, so, and I should have preempted all of this, but I work in the big A affordable housing world. So that means I secure all of the limited resources that the city has, and I attempt to cobble together a 300-unit deal, or in some cases, you know, at this point, the types of LIHTC, low-income housing tax credit transactions that we're doing, they're 50-unit deals. So they're not, to Leon's point, they're not the end-all, be-all. We can't, that is not the only thing. I also am not saying that we should ever remove that program from just in the event that David and I will not turn this conversation into that debate. But here again, so I do think scale is the issue we're all contending with this land. The programs that exist through the Cook County Land Bank, through the Missing Middle Program, those are creating great opportunities for emerging businesses to begin, to pursue a development. Some aren't even emerging businesses. Some are well established. I think I have only recently started to understand some of our issues around building within the neighborhoods at the single-family home, three-bet level, because of our work on Quantum, which is where we do have an opportunity to look at 40 lots and develop a product that would bring people back into the neighborhood that's adjacent to the Quantum Shore site. So I've been working with a colleague, Doran Gibson, and I've been now talking to Mary Kenny a lot about this work. But I am now convinced that we need to figure out some kind of home building tool, some large scale. And you know, my idea would be that we would sit down with the trades who have otherwise not been in this space because we haven't seen the decline in single-family home building at such a rate as we have in the last 20, 30 years. A lot of our housing stock was built with federal incentives where they came out and they just, sort of put it all up one fell swoop, just like a not domino, but the opposite of dominoes. And so how do we replicate that? Again, unfortunately, I don't think that's dollars from the city to do that, but I do think that's stakeholders from the city, policymakers, folks really getting behind something like this so that we can then attract this type of building model.
Yeah, so you touched on home building. So what's interesting is of that 1.5 million homes that's built in America every year, three-fourths of that are single-family homes. So by far, that continues to be the dominant housing form in the country. And of that 1.5 million, 20% of that is built by 10 national home builders. So that's the Pulteys, the Lennars, the D.R. Horton, the Ryan Homes. Not one of those home builders is in the city of Chicago. Not one of them. And they've ringed the entire Chicago suburban area. You go to Northwest Indiana, you go to Plainfield, you go to West Aurora. We met with the folks from D.R. Horton. They're actually building an entire town called Pingree Grove. Have you ever heard of Pingree Grove, Illinois? It's out near Rockford. 2,000 new units of housing going in there. So, and that hasn't always been the case. Our city was built by home builders. I mean, if you look at the bungalow belt, those were home builders. And after the crash in 2008, whatever home building industry, and we actually had home builders, folks like Lexington and Bigelow, and you had George Thrush, and we don't have a home thing. We have great developers, and you know, folks like Related and DL3, and you know, we have great developers, and we got great contractors. Well, we don't have home builders. So I think we need to get serious about recruiting home builders to come back to Chicago and build at scale, because they're building at scale. They're building hundreds of units. I mean, you go to Crown Point or Lowell or some of these places, they're building homes where they're buying the land, getting it entitled, putting in infrastructure, and making money at price points in the 350s, $350,000. And so we've got to get serious about recruiting home builders to actually build in the city of Chicago. So, Leon, what are thoughts you might have?
I agree. I mean, you guys are underscoring some real important supply side.
Talk about the demand side.
Yeah, and let me just put a point on that supply side before I move over. Is that, you know, we have the International Building Code, which is adopted by basically the rest of the United States, and then we have the Chicago Building Code. you know, why? So we have to ask ourselves why on some of these things. Some of it is historical, some of it is influence. But, I mean, historical fact being that we did suffer a great fire, a calamity. So that, you know, we became very prescriptive about the materials and the methods of construction. Most of the rest of the country is focused on performance and allows a lot more innovation in terms of how do you actually meet the performance targets. If we can get that mindset, that will be helpful for the home builders and others who want to come here. I think the other, you know, challenge is people, you know, property taxes are an issue that we have to address. And you see right now that just came out this weekend talking about we're starting to see growth in neighborhoods we all, well, not us, but many folks had written off. You know, there was an article just in the Tribune this past weekend that featured a realtor. Hello, realtors. said that, you know, she was seeing an uptick in terms of places like Inglewood in South Shore, you know, where people, investors are now buying in. My point is that I think, you know, government exists to do the things the private sector cannot do. So there's a role for government. And I like to see government, you know, come in and actually stimulate and stir the pot so that the scale of the private sector cannot be matched by government. It cannot be matched by our philanthropic and charitable sector, right? But government is the impulse of inertia. You know, policy changes at the government level do help and encourage private sector investment. So when you're saying home builders, you're essentially saying more private sector investment in our communities. And I think there are some things that can be done pretty simply, actually, you know, if the political will exists to get it done. And I think citizens now are saying they have that political will. On the demand side of the equation, you know, it's really a couple things. One is that we have to provide more jobs and opportunity, head of household jobs, as I like to say. And, you know, that means that whether, you know, we're building an industrial facility over on Roosevelt Road or like one that we're building out in Morgan Park on 119th Street to provide the head of household jobs that will be necessary for people to even afford the homes you want to build. So you got to have that job piece of the equation also front of mind. So that means continuing to attract corporations to make investment in Chicago, encouraging our corporate stakeholders that are staying in Chicago to want to invest in more creative ways. You know, we, as you know, we did, you know, invested with Discover, now Capital One. We invested with Blue Cross Blue Shield, created over 2,000 jobs just with those two projects. So there are corporations that want to make investments in an equitable way, an inclusive way. And yes, I'm still using those words when it means something. And so, you know, it does make sense, right? But we're not going to get corporations to do things that do not make sense. When I say make sense, do not make profit sense, right? A corporation has the goal of being profitable. We want to honor that. But they also bring urgency to the capital stack. So we got to provide jobs, and we got to be focused on jobs. And I can go into some other ideas, but I know we're running short on time.
All right. So, Dan, I'll turn it back to you for some questions.
We do. I know we have a very engaged audience. I'm hearing lots of chatter. So I'd love to ask. I have a couple of questions. If anyone has one, please raise your hand. I'll come by. I see one over here. Just raise them now so I can kind of map my way out. Hopefully, please keep them quick. I'm going to make sure this is working. Please keep them quick and introduce yourself. I will come around and hopefully we can get answered two or three of these.
Hi, I'm Scott Henry. I'm with Celadon Holston. And I don't know if I have a question. It's more of a comment for everybody. At Celadon Holston, we know that we're not perfect, and we try and navigate that imperfection through, we instill this idea of brutal honesty amongst all of us. So if there's something wrong, it doesn't work, we want to hear it so that we can get to the root problem and solve it. It leads to uncomfortable discussions, but we got to have those discussions. I think that we would have probably all had a more productive discussion today if somebody spiked our water with truth serum. I think we all know what the problems are, and I just encourage that we have that conversation with brutal honesty. It's the only way that we're going to move things forward. That's my comment.
I think I'm trying to be as straightforward and transparent as possible.
It didn't come up, but one of the things that I also feel like we need to start looking at is the actual numbers of production. What are we actually looking at here? We can celebrate, you know, that we've created a program, but we really need to be looking at how many units are we producing a year, and then dialing it back from there.
Hi, Juan Carlos Ignatis with Association House in Lucha. Good to see you up there. My question is with regards to, I mean, I guess we're compounding it with climate resilience, right? Background, for those of you who know Lucha, we built the first passive house certified building in Chicago. It's still there in Humboldt Park, beautiful building, six flat. The dual problem back then in 2018 was, as you mentioned, we were crying back then when it was $350,000 a unit, right, for that passive house unit. It's probably triple the cost now. And secondly, the Department of Buildings, and I used to work at the city, I know you did too, but even back then we're like, we don't care what San Francisco does, we don't care what New York does. Yep. It took the mayor himself to do a variance to get this done. So what are your thoughts on climate resilience?
Yeah, no, I think we've got to build into the equation, you know, making sure that we're, whether it's, you know, alternative energy options or, you know, more sustainable options. I think those are all important. I think what we've got to start to do, though, is make the case that it actually creates savings, operating savings. And I've asked this question 1,000 times. I mean, I know that the city has been pushing for more energy efficiency, but I've yet to see a deep study in terms of what that actually translates into in terms of real savings, like dollars. And so I think if we're going to have a frank conversation about, like, why are we doing all these and why is it costing more to do it, We've got to start to look at some of those. I can tell you, we've done a lot of buildings with energy efficiency. I can't say that it saved us on our energy bills. I mean, I can't say that it hasn't, but I mean, the energy bills keep going like this. So something ain't working.
That cost.
And it might, maybe that's rates, maybe that's, I don't know, other factors, other fees, but we have to make an economic case for energy efficiency, not just a climate change or social.
I think that's a great point. Sarah, did you want to add something to that?
Okay.
So what I'm going to say is that, you know, technology is an important piece of this equation. Cities themselves were a technological invention. But, you know, we have to, there are lots of technologies coming. We got, you know, we can produce housing, you know, through printers, 3D printers, potentially. We've got, you know, some of the climate, you know, solutions that are out there, green building and so forth. I think the challenge happened with today's point is that when government mandates, you know, sometimes you get, you know, some outcomes that are more perverse that you didn't plan for.
More what?
Perverse and that we didn't plan for. So what happens, for example, just quick example, you know, going to all electric homes. That makes some sense, you know, when, you know, before data centers were taking up all of the grid capacity. And so who could have planned for that, right? So it made sense, but now that you have, you know, the renters, the homeowners that you're trying, the very people you're trying to help by providing a more efficient solution through a government mandate now runs headlong into the macroeconomic environment where we have data centers that are gobbling up more capacity actually right now than the grid can even produce. So we're braced for electric rates, you know, electricity rates to go through the ceiling. That's just an example. But on the climate side, the positive is that Chicago is a climate refuge, and I think that we can grow and attract people here to Chicago and help, you know, build our economy.
So here's the thing I can't reconcile with climate resiliency, which is something that I believe heavily in. We're in a housing crisis, so we're choosing, this sort of aligns with what I was talking about earlier, we're choosing to focus on all these other policy initiatives and not able to get to the heart of what we need to do, which is to build more housing. And so I think we have to make some hard decisions and choose our battles. We don't get it all, and especially I would also say that a lot of times when these policy initiatives are placed on development, it all happens on the affordable housing development community. We tend to have to do all the things because it's tied to various resources, and we're talking about 50 units of housing that is intended to meet people who need housing most, who don't have options in the marketplace. And so I think we have to start backing away from putting it all on that type of project, and also acknowledging that we have to make some hard choices. Are we building housing, or are we, you know, building resilient cities? We want to do both, but again, I feel like the pressure to house people right now is really big.
We have time for one more quick one.
Sure. Hi, everybody. Anthony Simkin with Neighborhood Housing Services, and actually wanted to build off a comment that Leon just made. There's a lot of talk about some of the, especially regulatory barriers to building housing at scale, comparisons to Texas and North Carolina and other places. But to what extent is that just maybe just reflective of larger national migration patterns? Not necessarily a difficulty in building housing in Chicago. And that's connected to a second question I have, which is when you start talking about building at scale, what is the importance, and this is something the NHS is leaning into now, what is the importance of geographic concentration, right? We got lots of places that you can build housing, but if you want to have real, both economic and physical impact, right, on neighborhoods, I'd like your thoughts on sort of geographic concentration.
Why don't you take the? I'll touch on the. I guess more on the supply side. I mean, we've all seen the recent reports. I mean, Chicago is outpacing really the entire country in terms of housing appreciation. I mean, I think it was like 5.5%. You know, home sale price growth. And similarly with rents, which it's great for those of you that are landlords or looking to sell your home. It's terrible for affordable rental and first-time home buyers. And that, to me, that is we have the demand. I think that's the evidence. The demand is there. The issue is we just haven't been creating a supply to be able to absorb that demand. And if you look again at the permits, when we're permitting, you know, 4,500 units entirely throughout the city, we're not even coming close to kind of what the demand is, just in terms of population growth. And so we've got to get back to, you know, building units and creating more supply. Leon?
I couldn't agree more with that. And just to give you some perspective in terms of the national picture, even Dallas, which was building almost half of all new housing last year, is going to take 50 years for them to even get, even at that current rate, to get into balance. Just to give you some perspective on the size and scope of the problem that we're facing. In terms of geographic concentration, I mean, that is incredibly important, because if you're talking about going into disinvested neighborhoods, you've got a range of issues going on in those communities, right? And in order to bring the mix of demographics you need to support a development, you've got to attract people who have incomes, who have choices, right? So then what does that mean? That means you need to address the big three, which I always say. People are saying, okay, where am I going to shop and eat? Where are my kids going to go to school? And how safe are my streets? And if you can address those, not in a macro, like the whole city of Chicago is. So that our superintendent is, Stelling is doing a fantastic job. I think we can all agree. I mean, really has been doing a fantastic job. But this is a cake that's going to have to be eaten at a slice at a time. So if you can concentrate investment in nodal intersection, transportation, centered development, like we're doing in South Shore with Thrive Exchange, right next to the Quantum and the new Advocate facility, because where are those folks going to live? We don't want them to be lunchbox workers where they bring their food in with them every day. They sit there on the facility and eat their lunch and then go home. We want to create an opportunity for them to live and grow and raise their families in that community, right, and bring the incomes with them. So the thing is, we got to create, I believe, concentrated investment, not spreading the peanut butter, too thin, as Dave and I used to always talk about, but really that concentrated investment is can be catalytic and can be attracting of additional investment over time.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thanks. Especially for the comment about brutal truth and honesty. We are so committed here at City Club to having these difficult conversations. Even when you have these facts and figures, they can all be interpreted differently, and everyone has different stories they're telling and different things they're doing. So, like I said, this is going to be the first of many, and hopefully we'll have more voices at this conversation to keep moving the ball forward. And in that spirit, I'd like to ask, and if anyone does have ideas for how to keep this conversation going, please call me or email, or you can email our general info at cityclub-chicago.org. We're having another conversation after today to decide how to keep moving with this topic. So we appreciate everybody's input and understand you all are experts in your field. So thank you for anything there. We do plan to have more of these conversations, and hopefully all focus on moving things forward, right? We understand and admit history and historical, what has gotten us to this point. But here we are doing, so many of you doing great things to keep things going forward, and also great to have public servants and policymakers here to not only listen and share the great things that they're doing, but understand and be open to ways to move things forward. So I thought this was a great discussion. Thank you, David, for managing that. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Leon. Some incredible insights and so much more to come. Thank you. If you're around tomorrow, we have Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart coming. We've got the Water Commissioner, Randy Connor, on September 30th. Advance Illinois on Education, October 1st. Mismeasuring Impact in the Nonprofit Sector, October 15th. Ambassador Rahm Emanuel on October 23rd. And Fighting Economic Blight, a statewide model for betting on Main Street, October 29th. A lot of those are sold out, so if you're members, you're going to get a first shot at that wait list, so make sure you re-up your membership, and hopefully come back to City Club soon. Enjoy this beautiful day. Thanks again for being here.